We're back with another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at the Federalist. As always, you can email the show at radio@thefederalist.com. Follow us on Twitter at FDRLST. Make sure to subscribe wherever you download your podcasts as well. Today's conversation is with Ovik Roy. Ovik is the president of the Foundation for Research on Equal Opportunity. He's a policy editor at Forbes. He's a senior advisor at the Bipartisan Policy Center and at the Bitcoin Policy Institute. I've wanted to have Ovik on the show for a long time because an essay he wrote on crypto, I think it was for National Affairs a while ago, has been one of the most consequential things in terms of shaping my opinion that I've consumed, one of the most consequential takes. It's so interesting. And as I talk about with Ovik in this episode, I sort of go back and forth on crypto between the far left perspective and maybe the libertarian perspective on it. That essay that he wrote, along with an essay in Jacobin, which I believe compares crypto to a Ponzi scheme, those have been really helpful in shaping my take on it. And you've heard a little bit on crypto from Matt Stoller, who covers this on his Substack, which is called Big. It's an excellent subscription. You should definitely check it out, and you should check out his perspective and the Jacobin article as well. But I really wanted to talk to Ovik about all of the changes in the crypto space that have occurred over the last few months. And also about inflation. I'm really careful when we cover both of these because I'm not an expert by any means on either topic. And I think it's important to hear from experts on both topics. And so it was just a delight to have this conversation with Ovik about what's happening in both spaces, how they're both connected to each other. Obviously, huge, huge consequential topics that are affecting the everyday lives of every single American around the country right now. And in terms of crypto, millions and millions of people, and will have a very profound effect on the future. It was just a fascinating conversation. So grateful to Ovik. He has a Substack through the Foundation for Research on Equal Opportunity. It has a Substack now, and he has a newsletter. The organization has a newsletter via Substack that you can subscribe to. The website is freeop.org to find out more about the Foundation for Research on Equal Opportunity. But please enjoy, I hope you enjoy as much as I did, this conversation with Ovik Roy, which was recorded on July 6th over Zoom. Ovik, you're a busy man.
Hey, Emily. Yeah, that's what my wife tells me.
Okay, so you guys have a Substack over at the Foundation for Research on Equal Opportunity now that folks should subscribe to. And one of the first posts that I saw when I took a look at it was really interesting. It was headlined, "Inflation is Worse Than You Think." It got into this, I think, really important question that is being overlooked by the media on how inflation actually exacerbates inequality. Ovik, I was hoping you could start by just breaking down what you broke down for readers of the Substack. Why is inflation worse than folks might think it is, given that people probably think it's as bad as it could get?
Well, there's a bunch of different reasons. It's an important topic. So, Emma, I appreciate you your interest in it. And I'm sure a lot of the Federalist listeners will be interested because obviously everyone's experiencing inflation, but there's a couple important things to understand about inflation. The first is that inflation, as you normally read about it in the newspaper or your favorite media source, is that the official inflation statistics, the consumer price index for all urban consumers is one, CPIU, and the other that the Federal Reserve likes to use is the personal consumption expenditures index, or PCE. They're pretty similar. Those are based on, inflation, there's no objective number for inflation. So if you think about it, like, how do you experience inflation as an ordinary person, right? You go to the gas station, you go to the grocery store, you know, you pay for various things and you notice the prices are going up, right? But what is actually the inflation number? The inflation number, at least with CPI and PCE, is a bunch of bureaucrats, literally at the Bureau of Labor Statistics, who basically make assumptions about what the average person consumes on a daily or monthly basis and says, okay, based on this basket of consumption, here's how much food that the average person consumes, here's how much housing the average person consumes, et cetera, et cetera. We're going to create this basket that says, okay, what are those prices? And so there's two elements of it. What is in the basket? What is the basket of goods we think the average person consumes? And then how do we measure the price trends of those various items in the basket? And so why is inflation worse than the official statistics think? There's three reasons for it. The first is that the basket of goods that the government thinks you consume is not necessarily accurate, right? It really depends on your life situation. You may be in a situation where housing is really a bigger expense for you because maybe you live in a high cost part of the country where housing is really expensive. Or maybe you live in a rural area where you have to drive 2 hours every day. And so the price of gas really matters to you, right? So there are things like that where that CPI basket doesn't necessarily reflect your daily experience. The second piece is that the actual way in which the government measures these variations in pricing is a bit dodgy at times. So, for example, the way in which the government measures the price of housing is not by actually looking at Zillow or some other website and saying, okay, how much has the median home price increased over the last year or month? But they do a survey and they ask people, okay, if you were to rent out the house that you own, how much do you think you could get per month of rent? And if you're like me, you know, I only own one house, which is my house. Like, I don't know how much it would rent for. Like, I've never tried to rent out my house. I'm not looking at those statistics. So you just fill out the form and you guess, but that's literally the way in which the government measures home inflation, as opposed to looking at objective numbers like, how much are homes selling for? How much is rent going for these days in different parts of the country? And so on that measure alone, what is housing costing you? And basically in the CPI basket, 30% of it in one form or another is housing. So if you're measuring housing incorrectly, you're measuring inflation incorrectly. And it turns out that over the last 12 months, the average home price in America has increased by 25%. But according to CPI, housing prices have only increased by 5%. And so that difference between 25% and 5%, if you do the math, ends up meaning that we're mismeasuring inflation by anywhere between 3 and 5%. So the official inflation rate is around 8%. It's actually more like 13% if you just measure housing correctly. So one of the ways in which housing is worse than you think is, as I mentioned, you as an individual may be consuming things that make you more sensitive to certain prices, like fuel, like housing. Another way is that housing itself is being understated. Housing inflation is being understated by the government in ways that mean that as those numbers start to catch up with one another, over time, you're going to see official inflation statistics are going to continue to be high because the real housing number is high and the fake housing number is not, and it has to catch up with the real housing. So that's another element of why inflation is worse than you think. And the third and the most important, and I apologize for going on about this, but it's an important topic. The third piece is that inflation affects you differently based on whether you're rich or poor or middle income, right? So if you're making $600,000 a year, then the fact that your rent goes up a little bit or your gas prices go up a little bit may not affect you that much because, okay, so if I'm paying an extra $50 a month at the pump for my gas, but I make $600,000 a year, who cares, right? It's not that big of a deal. On the other hand, if you're making $20,000 a year, every dollar matters. You're barely skating by as it is. And so anytime any price increases for you, it's crushing. So as a percentage of your income, your inflation may actually be significantly more costly to you if you're lower income or working class or middle class than if you're wealthy. And in fact, if you're wealthy, inflation may actually benefit you because one of the ways in which, we were talking about the consumption basket before, right? The CPI. Well, you know, what's not in the CPI? The stock market, because, you know, you don't consume stocks the way you consume milk or eggs or gasoline. So if you're wealthy though, you have investments, you have a stock portfolio, you own your home, you have, you might have even venture capital or private equity investments. And those things tend to really fly up in value in inflationary environments. So if you're wealthy, not only do you not care about the fact that the price of milk may be higher, you're actually making money because all your stock investments are actually going up a lot in an inflationary environment. Whereas if you're making $20,000 a year, you don't have a stock portfolio. You don't own a home. And so you're not benefiting from inflation the way wealthy people are, and it's hitting you harder because those everyday expenditures are a bigger share of your household budget. Mm-hmm. So for all those reasons, it's really important to understand that CPI is an attempt at looking at the average American's experience with inflation. And for a lot of different reasons, pretty much everybody is not average. And so if you think about, say, you know, the average person may be experiencing inflation of 8-9%. There's a quarter of the population which is experiencing inflation at, you know, 20% or 30%. And for those people, what's happened over the last year or two has been just devastating. And so, you know, you have all these people in Washington saying, oh, why is everyone so mad about inflation? Well, because it's devastating for tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions of Americans.
Mm-hmm. Why is it that we have such a system that's set up to be such a poor gauge or barometer of you know, what people are actually experiencing?
It's a legacy of 20th century industrial thinking, right? Where you had a domestic rather than a global economy, where everyone was kind of buying the same things, or there was just less diversity in terms of consumption habits relative to today. And, you know, we didn't have big data. You know, we didn't have a lot of the tools we have now to really fine tune the analysis. You know, statistics were a lot more primitive in the 1950s and 1930s. You know, really it was the 1930s when a lot of this stuff really started to come to the fore, because you started to have more central planning of the economy. And so all the, you know, Harvard PhDs who were trying to plan the economy had to have statistics with which to plan the economy. And so they started generating some of these measures, and they're still used today. I mean, the Federal Reserve is arguably the most important and most powerful central planning agency of the economy in the history of the United States, because they have incredible authority and power that isn't really democratically accountable.
Mm. Yeah, that has been abundantly obvious. And I think a lot of folks are obviously feeling that acutely at this moment. Now, at the beginning, I said a lot of people probably think inflation is as bad as it can get. I misspoke, because I think a lot of people realize that there's room for it to get much, much worse. What do you think people can expect out of the next year, looking ahead? Is there anything meaningfully that the Biden administration, the Fed, can do to eat away at this, or that they will do, that they have the political will to do in and of itself, that'll start to make a difference in people's bank accounts?
Well, first of all, you know, the average age in America, the median age of an American, I believe, is 39 years. So that means that for at least half the population, for majority of the population, this is the first time in their lives they've experienced meaningful inflation. Now, for people who are a little older, who remember the 1970s, we had inflation that was 15-20% at times in the 70s. And I taught, there's a piece I wrote for National Affairs last year called Bitcoin and the U.S. Fiscal Reckoning, which talks about this history of how when we left the gold standard under Nixon fully and forever in 1971, that really created this massive wave of inflation in the 1970s that Jimmy Carter got blamed for, but really was Nixon's fault. And so people who remember that experience know what it's like to live in a time of acute inflation. And what's really tragic is that there was a school of thought in Washington, not just on the left, but on the right as well, that those days were behind us. We'd mastered inflation. There was no need to worry about it anymore. So we could do all these crazy things in terms of spending $6 trillion we didn't have, creating $6 trillion out of thin air at the Fed that we didn't have, and that would have no effect on inflation. And here we are.
All right, so think about this. Many of us spend more time every day in our office chair than we do in our cars or in our beds. And that's why it's so important to invest in the right chair, so that you spend those hours with the right level of support and the right level of comfort, and then you get the most productivity out of your day too. X Chair has made my time at my desk not only more productive, but it's honestly one of my favorite places to sit for any reason. In fact, I'm sitting in it right now. Not only does X Chair's patented dynamic variable lumbar, or DVL, offer the ultimate customized support, but my X Chair can even give give me a massage or heat up or cool down. And now, thanks to X-Chair's new FS360 armrests, I can even adjust my armrests to the perfect position. It is truly an incredible chair. All these unique X-Chair features help the hours at my desk fly by in complete comfort. That's why I love my X-Chair. Again, I'm sitting in it right now. Go to xchairfederalist.com now. That's the letter X, chair, FederalistCom, or call 1-844-4-X-CHAIR for $100 off your order. X-Chair has a 30-day guarantee of complete comfort, and you can finance your purchase for as little as $30 a month. xchairfederalist.com. Say you were counseling Joe Biden. You had the wonderful job of counseling Joe Biden. What steps would you advise him to take?
Well, there's two ways to answer that question. So the first is what's best for the country, and the second is what's best for Biden politically. And let's start with the second first. Since, when you're a policy advisor, that's usually a major consideration. If I were working in the White House, that would be a something that I'd have to factor in, right? And the fact is, when it comes to the politics of inflation, there are very few good solutions because the go-to technique for tackling inflation on the macroeconomic side. Well, first, let's step back a minute. So there's two elements to inflation. If we want to be very general and very broad, there's two kinds of inflation. There's what we might call macroeconomic inflation and microeconomic inflation. So what do I mean by that? Macroeconomic inflation means inflation that's due to very broad-based tools, such as the way the Federal Reserve sets interest rates, or the way the Federal Reserve controls the number of dollars circulating in the economy, the money supply. Those kinds of macroeconomic factors can play a significant role in inflation. So, for example, if you keep interest rates very low, it makes it easier for people and particularly financial institutions to borrow money. And if you borrow a lot of money and then pump it in the economy, there's more money chasing the same amount of goods and services, and that makes the price of those goods and services go up. That's a form of macroeconomic inflation. Another form of macroeconomic inflation is you increase the quantity of dollars in the economy. So if you double the number of dollars in the economy, but the economy stays the same size, then each of those dollars is effectively worth half of what it was before. And that means the price is double because each dollar is worth half of what it was before. So if it costs you a dollar to buy, a quart of milk or whatever, and now it costs $2 to buy a quart of milk because your dollar has half the purchasing power it had before, prices have doubled. So those are forms of macroeconomic inflation. There's also microeconomic inflation, which are things like, well, if we shut down the economy due to a plague and nobody can actually produce computer chips, then the few computer chips that are left cost a lot more, or the cars they go into or the computers they go into, the prices of those goods and the supply goes up and the supply of those goods goes down. Or if we do things like, say, we try to prohibit or prevent the producers of oil or natural gas from actually generating that production and delivering it to consumers, and you thereby constrain the supply of fossil fuels, that can lead to an increase in energy prices. Those are microeconomic forms of inflation where due to regulation or subsidies or some other, more specific government action, you drive, there are price increases because of that, that are not due to more general factors like interest rates and the quantity of money in the economy. So if you think about that, say, okay, there's two kinds of inflation, microeconomic and macroeconomic. And then if you're Biden, what can you do? On the microeconomic side, there's a lot you can do that is, I think, politically attractive. You can unleash the shackles of the economy, have a regulatory reform agenda that says, hey, if you want to produce more energy, go for it. If you want to produce more computer chips, go for it. Do it. Now, of course, you know, people on Biden's left are not going to like that agenda, particularly on the energy side. But if he wants to actually win an election, those are some of the things that are in his control that he can do to, you know, address high prices. That's not what he's doing, as we know. He's saying it's the gas station's fault that your gas prices are high, not his fault, which is, you know, economically illiterate if he's even being truthful in describing it that way. So, but all that to say, there is a politically attractive agenda there, so long as he doesn't care about making the left mad. On the macroeconomic side, it's a little tougher, because if you really want to curb inflation on the macroeconomic side, the things you need to do are things like raise interest rates, which the Fed has been doing to a very, very incremental and modest degree. You can curtail the money supply, so curtail the growth of the supply and the quantity of U.S. dollars, which again would make each dollar worth more, but that would dramatically affect the stock market. We've already seen the stock market go down a lot as interest rates have gone up. That's another way to hurt the stock market, and that can create a recession or create short-term economic pressures that would increase unemployment, for example. The other thing you could do is you could balance the budget. You could say, hey, we're gonna reduce federal spending, and thereby the artificial stimulus that comes from federal spending into the economy, and in that way, reduce inflation. But of course, Biden is not particularly excited about reducing spending. He's moved in the other direction. He's wanted to dramatically increase federal spending by trillions of dollars. So that's not really on his list. There's other things he can do that are more subtle, but that he's not going to do. To give one example, he could appoint, instead of appointing Jay Powell for a second 7-year term as the chairman of the Fed, he could have appointed someone who's much more hawkish on interest rates, who would have been willing to raise interest rates and curb inflation. Now, traditionally, that's more of a conservative point of view on macroeconomic policy and not a progressive point of view on macroeconomic policy. So again, that would have gone against his instincts, but he could have done it. I mean, Jimmy Carter was a Democrat. He appointed Paul Volcker to the Fed, and Paul Volcker is the one who really conquered inflation in the early 80s. So there is a history in the Democratic Party, if you go back far enough, of people who've been more hawkish and conservative on monetary policy being in charge of the Fed. But that's not where Biden is being pushed. The Elizabeth Warrens of the world want him to go in the opposite direction, have a more dovish policy at the Fed where you keep interest rates low and continue to drive inflation. So the pressures he's feeling from his left go in the opposite direction on both microeconomic and macroeconomic policy, which is why he's really struggled to do anything. Because the correct policies, if you want to tackle inflation, are to lighten up on regulations, to raise interest rates, and to reduce federal spending. And none of those things are things that Biden is excited about doing.
Are we in a recession? I know we're expecting some job numbers on Friday. Do you think we're already in a recession? Do you think, if not, we're headed for a recession? What do you make of that?
That's another one where, you know, there's an official definition of what a recession is and what isn't, and we'll have to wait for the official statistics to determine whether we're officially in a recession or not. What I would say is that it's clear that that it's going to be hard to avoid a recession when we're in this environment where we have to raise interest rates to keep inflation at bay. Typically speaking, if you look at historical episodes that are like the one we're in, if you have high inflation and you raise interest rates to keep inflation lower, there is going to be a significant increase in unemployment as a result, and a significant decrease in economic growth as a result. So that's the typical pattern. The Fed is trying to avoid that by raising interest rates very gradually. But again, it's this sort of catch-22, is if you raise interest rates too gradually, you don't tackle inflation. If you raise interest rates too quickly, you do tackle inflation, but there's an economic crash. So that's the challenge that is created by the misguided policies we've had since really the financial crisis in 2008 around monetary policy. And now we're paying the price for it.
All right, I know I've said this before, but I'll say it again. One of the reasons I'm in journalism is because I'm just relentlessly skeptical of absolutely everything, including those glowing MyPillow ads that we all see so much of. But my own skepticism, personally, was just gone immediately after trying MyPillow, which I really love. Did you know that MyPillow is also about more than just a fantastic pillow, though? Now MyPillow has given the same attention that they've given to those pillows I love so much to their new MyPillow Percale bed sheets. The sale of the year on those MyPillow Percale bed sheets is going on right now. The regular price for queen size sheets is $89.98, but now that's only $39.98 with your promo code. They're breathable, cool, and crisp. They're durable, built to last, machine washable for easy care, available in a variety of styles, colors, and sizes, and they also have a 60-day money-back guarantee and a one-year limited warranty. So go to MyPillow.com/Federalist or call 800-794-8429 for deep discounts on the MyPillow Percale bed sheets. Queen size regular for the price of $89.98 are now on sale for only $39.98. While there, you can take advantage of the buy one, get one sale on MyPillows, towels, and more. Visit MyPillow.com/Federalist or call 800-794-8429 today for the sale of the year on MyPillow Percale bed sheets. MyPillow.com/Federalist or call 800-794-8429. And this is going to be a little bit of a gear switch, although I think the two questions are related, or the two topics are related in ways that I'm curious for what you think. But I actually just wanted to ask, that National Affairs essay you referenced has been one of the most persuasive things that I've read on crypto, period. And there are two articles I point to. There's yours, there's another one in Jacobin. That's just, I just don't know which direction to go in after I read both of them. I've reread yours. I've just found you to be really a helpful thinker on this. And I was curious how you got involved in basically the crypto world. You've been involved for a while. How did that start for you?
Well, first of all, what's this Jacobin piece? I got to check that out.
It's what is it called? It has a really good title too. I think
it send it to me later.
I will. I think it calls Bitcoin a pyramid screen, a pyramid scheme.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. first of all, it's important, I think, to distinguish between Bitcoin and crypto. Crypto is a very broad category that includes basically any digital project that uses a blockchain. We can get into what a blockchain is if people are really interested in, but Bitcoin is a very specific implementation of crypto that has distinctive qualities that make it very different and important relative to the broad range of crypto. It's kind of like, you know, there's software and there is a web browser, right? Like a web browser is a thing you use every day. Not all software is something you use every day or is even useful at all, right? Mm-hmm. So similarly, there's crypto, which is this broad category of stuff, much of which is useless, some of which is useful. And there's Bitcoin, which actually is very important and potentially transformative for the economy, for society, and not just in the US, but in the world. And you asked, like, how did I get into it? So I got into it because before I started writing about politics and policy, I worked on Wall Street as a hedge fund investor for a dozen years at Bain Capital and JP Morgan, a few other places. And I was mainly investing in healthcare companies. That's how I got into healthcare policy. But the, just managing a portfolio, you become very attuned to how to get your portfolio to work in very different economic and financial environments. So one thing you hear a lot of portfolio managers talk about, obviously people talk about this more broadly, is how you diversify your portfolio, right? And there's different kinds of diversification techniques. One of which is, the theory is if you own like 100 different stocks, then you're diversified because, you know, you'll benefit from the overall stock market going up. But if any one of those stocks blows up, it won't hurt your portfolio. That's one theory of diversification, which is less interesting to me personally, but is widely discussed, right? There's another form of diversification, which is what we might call asset class diversification. So, you know, if you have all your money in the stock market, then your portfolio is going to go up and down when the stock market goes up and down. But what if you have your portfolio diversified between stocks and bonds and real estate and gold and you know, all sorts of things, which in theory may not be correlated to each other. So maybe in some environments, stocks go up, and other environments, real estate goes up. Now, that also has flaws as a theory, because it turns out when the Fed floods the market with money, everything goes up at the same time. But a part of why I got into a Bitcoin as an investor is because I was looking for uncorrelated assets to the stock market, and particularly hedges against the world ending through fiscal collapse. Because I'm like, you know, we're making a lot of progress in terms of driving ourselves over a cliff fiscally. And as someone who works on healthcare policy, because healthcare drives our deficit debt by far more than any other category of spending, you know, that's something I was aware of as a problem. So I'm like, okay, how can I personally protect my family's, you know, assets against that problem? And Bitcoin was a tool for that. It's something I'd been aware of from the beginning, just because Bitcoin is really, in many ways, as I write about in that National Affairs piece, the full-on manifestation of Austrian economic theory, which is the for those who don't know, it's really the great tradition of libertarian or free market economic theory, going back to Friedrich Hayek and Ludwig von Mises and people like that, and they talked a lot, Mises and Hayek did, about money, and they weren't the only ones, but they talked a lot about how, if you think about the hyperinflation in Weimar Germany, if you talk about World War II, you talk about a lot of the inflationary environments of the 70s, all that stems from basically government has an interest in increasing the money supply at your expense. Why? Because it's more efficient than taxation. Or if I want to raise your taxes, I have to pass a bill in Congress, and you're going to get mad at me for raising your taxes. But if I just turn a dial on my stereo that allows me to decrease the value of each dollar by 1%, and thereby I can do a lot of things policy-wise that I couldn't do before by making you feel like you have more money, but actually not really, because each of your dollars is worth less now. That's great as a politician, right? I can make the economy seem like it's going better. Everyone feels happier. The stock market is up. There's more money flowing through the economy. And it's only later that you realize that, yeah, more money is flowing through the economy because each of those dollars is worth less, and your savings have been diminished as a result. So politicians, kings, princes, governments like ours, have long had an economic interest in borrowing, spending money they don't have, decreasing the value of their debts by decreasing the value of the dollar, in our case, and making you feel good about it, right? So Milton Friedman once called it taxation without legislation. That's what inflation is. And so that's been a longstanding problem of governments in general, and it's certainly a big problem that we have in our country, particularly with the Federal Reserve having the kind of power that it has to be able to print money whenever it wants, and Congress effectively being able to spend money whenever it wants now. So Bitcoin is a solution, and it's not just a solution in the sense that ordinary people can protect themselves from this process by owning Bitcoin, because Bitcoin, unlike the US dollar, is only 21 million Bitcoin that will ever be produced. And as a result, you have that complete confidence in knowing that the price of Bitcoin relative to the US dollar may fluctuate, but the supply of Bitcoins will be constant over time. And that means as the dollar over the long term becomes less and less valuable because we print more dollars to make us feel good, and each dollar is worth less as a result, Bitcoin will have that solidity. So imagine it's like waterfront real estate in your town. So if you live on a lake, or you live on one of the oceans, on the coasts, there's only so much land, so many apartments or houses that can be on the waterfront. And so that real estate goes up in value because as people get wealthier in society, they still want to live on the water, right? And so those homes that are on the water go up in value. They appreciate more rapidly than homes that are maybe in the interior of a city or a region where it's just, you know, you have your two-bedroom house or two-bedroom apartment. It's like whatever, right? The same two-bedroom house on the water is gonna cost a lot more. So similarly, with it's like supply and demand. Anything that's scarcer, if there's demand for it, can go up in value. And so the value or the opportunity with Bitcoin is that it used to be, if you worried about the debt and deficits, like what's going to happen? Like, how is the debt and deficit going to actually play out? So a lot of us who are concerned about the debt, we say, hey, there's going to be this reckoning for the US if we keep running up these debts. And then the counter argument from the left, but not just the left, has been, well, you guys keep complaining about the debt and deficit, but we've been running debts and deficits for a long time and everything seems to be going great. You know, the economy seems to be going great. Unemployment's low, at least until recently. The economy is growing. So who cares about the deficit and debt? We can have this thing called modern monetary theory where it doesn't really matter. We could print dollars until the cows come home and everything's going to be fine because the U.S. runs the world and everyone sort of has to accept our hegemony economically. Well, that's not true. And Bitcoin is an example of the kind of stuff that emerges in a world in which people believe that it's true, right? If you mm-hmm. believe that you can double the supply or triple the supply or quintuple the supply of US dollars and no one's going to care because you're going to think that each dollar is worth the same as it was before, well, Bitcoin is effectively a response to that. It says, no, here's the soundest form of money that's ever existed, one that no legislature can change. There's no Congress or no Federal Reserve or no Biden or Trump who can change the value of each Bitcoin in its own, in the context of its own system. There's only going to be 21 million ever created. And so as a result, over the long term, people who look at Bitcoin and see it for what it is and understand that Bitcoin is something that over time could very well emerge as the world's premier store of value. And if it does emerge as that, then there's a lot of consequences for Americans and for U.S. policy because the U.S. won't be able to borrow in the same way it does today. Today, if the U.S. wants to borrow money, how does it borrow money? So we have $30 trillion in debt. How do we actually borrow the $30 trillion? Well, what we do is we issue treasury bonds, which pay an interest rate, and people buy the treasury bond and say, okay, U.S. government, you're going to pay me a 2% interest rate on this bond for 30 years or a 1% interest rate or a 0.25% interest rate or whatever the interest rate happens to be that the Fed effectively determines. And so what happens if people say, you know what, America, you're broke. We're not going to lend you any more money. We're not going to buy those treasury bonds because we don't think you're going to pay us back. What happens then? Mm-hmm. Interest rates go up. There's a major crisis. Because people gradually over time say, you know, we're going to own things, more things like Bitcoin and fewer things like treasury bonds, because we think treasury bonds are less reliable over a 30, 50, 100-year time frame relative to these other investments. And it's not a black and white binary decision. It's not like the German government says, for example, we don't like the U.S. treasury bonds anymore. We're going to take all our treasury bonds, dump them, and buy Bitcoin instead. No, it doesn't work that like. It works like, well, what if we just say, take 1% of our treasury bond holdings and convert them into Bitcoin. And then maybe next year it's 2%. Next year it's 3%. That incremental change over time can create a very big problem for the U.S. And we're seeing it. So this is not theoretical. We're actually seeing it. The share of U.S. treasury bonds owned by international investors has steadily declined over the last 15 years. And and who's making up for that share of treasury bonds that aren't being bought by the foreign governments and foreign investors? The Federal Reserve. So the Federal Reserve is buying the bonds that nobody else wants and putting them on the Federal Reserve's balance sheet. It's kind of like, Emily, if you ran up a huge credit card bill and then said, you know what, I have a brilliant idea. I'm not going to pay off my credit card. I'm going to pay off my first credit card by taking out a second credit card to pay off the first credit card. You know, that works for a while, but eventually you got to pay off the credit card, right? Whichever, mm-hmm. Nth credit card you end up having to pay. So all that to say that that's basically what the U.S. government is doing on a multi-trillion dollar scale. And I really fear for young people today, because this is a problem that young people will not be able to escape. My children are, just starting elementary school. When they're 50 or 60 years old, I mean, is there going to be a U.S. dollar to preserve, at least that has meaningful value? I think the jury's out on that. So the long-term and medium-term situation here is very problematic. The good news is it used to be, prior to the existence of Bitcoin, there was nothing you could do about it. other than leave the country, I guess. But there's nothing you could do. There was no, you know, nothing you could do as an individual to protect yourself against this problem. But now with the advent of Bitcoin, you are able to put a portion whatever scale you want of your savings into an instrument that the government can't debase. And that's really important.
Yeah, so I think that assessment is really well put. And I'm curious to ask the million-dollar question that I'm sure you've been pelted with a lot recently. The sharks are circling. The anti-crypto sharks have been circling over the last couple of months. And I could just hear them like salivating when you said it as the manifestation of Austrian economics. They're like, yes, exactly. It's always been wrong. Why aren't the last couple of months in crypto, the last, you know, I don't know, 3, 4, 5, 6 months in crypto, not a rebuttal to everything you just said? Why are they, again, like, this is the big question, the million trillion dollar question, but what's your answer to that, I guess, devil's advocate point?
So Warren Buffett, who actually, you know, hates Bitcoin, thinks it's the worst thing. And it's like, he calls it, I think, the greatest threat, or Charlie Munger called it the greatest threat to Western civilization or something like that. But, you know, Warren Buffett has a great quote that also Munger uses about stock market investing. He says, in the short term, the stock market is a voting machine. In the long term, the stock market is a weighing machine. Meaning over the short term, you know, it's like a poll. It's like a snap election, right? Like, prices in the market can go up and down, right? But over the long term, the true financial value of assets in a free market eventually shows up and wins out, right? And so if you're only looking at short-term price action, yes, Bitcoin is volatile. It's not the only volatile asset. There, you know, I used to invest in biotech stocks. Biotech stocks are pretty volatile too. So the volatility of Bitcoin on a return adjusted basis actually is very favorable. So if you actually, there's this metric that we professional investors like to use called the Sharpe ratio, which is what are your returns over time relative to the volatility of that particular instrument's price. And if you actually look at that on a volatility adjusted basis, Bitcoin outperforms every other asset class in the world over the last 10 years. So Bitcoin, even with all the volatility going up and down over the long term, has done very, very well. Remember 10 years ago, you know, each Bitcoin was worth like $30 or $100, you know? So it's now at $20,000, which is pretty good. You know, if you have an investment that goes from 100 to 20,000, you've done pretty well. Now some people are like, well, it was 60,000 last year, now it's 20,000. Great, yeah, that's true. If you bought at the top, you know, you're down on your investment, but if you've had a long-term view, you've done very well. And again, the price action is not the most important thing. It's more about this broader thing of over the long term, you know, how are you going to do? Is it a way of, you know, you don't have to put all your money in Bitcoin, but if you put a percentage that is, let's say you put 3% of your assets in Bitcoin, right? If Bitcoin goes to zero, you're only down 3%. However, if Bitcoin goes up to 200,000, you're up 27%. So it's an asymmetric bet in that way. And so structured the right way as an investment, and this is not investment advice. I am not, I'm not a professional investor anymore. So please take all this with a grain of salt. But just again, from a standpoint of portfolio theory, if you have the right investment approach to Bitcoin, you can take advantage of the possibility that Bitcoin plays out the way that I've described. But the most important thing to understand is that it's a long-term game. And by the way, it's not just about the price of Bitcoin relative to the US dollar. There's a couple other things to consider. One is the global environment. So, okay, whatever you think about inflation in the US right now, feel fortunate that you don't live in Venezuela or Turkey. Mm-hmm. In Turkey, which is theoretically a relatively developed country, you know, inflation is like 75% because they've mismanaged their macroeconomic policy. 75% inflation is pretty bad, right? So yeah, you could plow into US dollars if you want nearly 10% inflation or whatever, or you could, you know, own Bitcoin, right? So it's not, there are actually, if you look at Brazil, if you look at Turkey, there are a bunch of really big countries out there with large populations that are not the US, for whom the use case of Bitcoin as a protector against inflation is pretty significant. So it's really important for critics or skeptics of Bitcoin to understand that the US is not the only country in the world. And there are a lot of other countries that have very, very high inflation where the use of Bitcoin today is pretty compelling purely on an inflation basis. That's number one. Number two is Bitcoin is the perfect instrument to protect oneself against cancel culture. Because you cannot censor a Bitcoin transaction. If the faculty at Harvard or the Biden administration or your favorite big tech entity like YouTube, we were talking about YouTube before we started recording and the Federalists' special relationship with YouTube. If you want to pay someone through YouTube, Google can tell you to not do that anymore, right? But you can't do the same with Bitcoin. And that's, you could say that's positive and negative, right? But Edward Snowden, WikiLeaks, or I should say Julian Assange. So, when WikiLeaks was posting a lot of very sensitive stuff about national security in the U.S., and the U.S. government, the Congress actually passed a law preventing WikiLeaks from accessing the SWIFT system for international money transfers. They basically said, WikiLeaks said, okay, we'll accept donations in Bitcoin. And because they did that 10 years ago or 8 years ago, or whenever it was, those Bitcoin are now worth a lot of money. Mm-hmm. So they actually have done better financially, paradoxically, as a result of receiving donations in Bitcoin. In Ukraine, when the invasion happened on February 24th, it took a week because of all the complexities of international money transferring to get cash to Ukraine. If you sent Bitcoin to Ukraine, it happened in 5 minutes. It's like as fast as sending an email. So Ukraine raised over $100 million from Bitcoin transactions that again, was easier to in terms of sending money to Ukraine as an overnight email. Similarly, Alexei Navalny, the leader of the Russian opposition, obviously the Russians don't want him to have access to money, but his organization receives donations in Bitcoin from all over the world. So Bitcoin is an incredibly powerful technology for transferring economic value in a censorship-resistant way. And so even if you don't care about the inflation piece of Bitcoin, which I would argue is the most important, the censorship resistance piece is also extremely important. The ability to say, you know what, we can exchange value with each other, and the government is limited in its ability to prevent that transaction from happening.
So there's a big piece of legislation making its way through Congress. It's by someone who's been pretty supportive of crypto, Cynthia Lummis and Kirsten Gillibrand. And I'm curious, one of the big pieces of skepticism I've always had with crypto is that its value seems to be inherently lower in a regulatory environment. And it seems to me that it's impossible for it to escape existing in a regulatory environment for much longer. It just seems like an inevitable reality. What's your assessment of the Gillibrand-Lummis legislation? And am I wrong to think that the regulation of this is inevitable and dings the value in some way?
Yeah. So, I think that there's a couple things to say here. One, Bitcoin doesn't need regulation to exist, right? Bitcoin came into existence without any sort of law permitting its existence. So Bitcoin as a software network doesn't require legislation, and legislation can't prevent Bitcoin from existing as a monetary network. So in that sense, Bitcoin is sort of apart from the regulatory or legislative or political system. But if you want Bitcoin to have the widest possible adoption, if you want it to have mass market utility, then it does matter. The regulatory environment does matter. Take something as simple as exchanging US dollars for Bitcoin. Going to Coinbase or some other exchange and want to take the US dollars you have and converting them to Bitcoin. That what people call payment rail, that ability of or that financial rail of how you take the US dollars and convert them to Bitcoin, that is something that the government can regulate. For example, if you want to own Bitcoin without exchanging US dollars for Bitcoin, you have to do it by mining the Bitcoin yourself. which you can do. And so you don't, it's not, it isn't the, it's not, you know, that the only way to buy or obtain Bitcoin is through exchanging US dollars for Bitcoin. You can buy the computers or the machines that help you mine Bitcoin, and thereby obtain Bitcoin outside of that banking system or financial system. But for the typical person, they're going to buy Bitcoin by using an exchange, or the Cash App, for example, is another way you can do it. And that's something the government can regulate. There are lots of other businesses or financial institutions or entities or ventures or enterprises or innovations that you want to build on top of Bitcoin as a base layer, that in order to be able to do that, you're going to have some sort of regulatory architecture. And then the reason why you have to have a regulatory architecture is because if I want to start a business, let's say I want to start a business that allows people to borrow money against their Bitcoin holdings. So I happen to own $100,000 worth of Bitcoin, and I want to use that as my, as I want to borrow against that to pay for my house that I want to buy, right? If I want to do that, you know, that's going to have to be a regulated instrument, because that involves mm-hmm. certain kind of traditional financial processes. Now, if I start that business with and ignore the SEC and the Treasury Department and the Commodity Futures Trade Commission, things like that, you know, eventually the risk as an investor in that kind of business is maybe 10 years go by and everyone ignores me. And then I get this letter saying your business is illegal, shut it down right now. Right. And so you never want to be in that position as an investor or as an entrepreneur. You want to know that I'm putting all this blood, sweat and tears into this idea and it's going to be legal. And so the value of the Lummis Gillibrand bill is that it creates that regulatory clarity. And, you know, mm-hmm. I could go into a long discussion of, you know, each provision of it and whether I like it exactly the way it is or not. But broadly, I think they're directionally in the right place, which is the bill creates a lot of regulatory clarity. It particularly puts a lot of the regulatory authority for Bitcoin and crypto with the CFTC, not the SEC. The SEC has been particularly kind of a bungling and incompetent institution in terms of regulating Bitcoin and crypto. And so putting it in the hands of the CFTC is going to be better for innovators and entrepreneurs relative to the SEC. And another thing that the bill does that's really useful is it says if you're transacting in Bitcoin at under $200 per transaction, so if you're buying your cup of coffee or whatever, we're not going to make you do a complicated tax calculation to do that. That's going to be fine. And that creates a little bit more utility to Bitcoin in terms of being able to use it for everyday purchases in a way that is a little bit more complicated in the US today, less so in other countries where they already have a lot of these rules in place. So there's a bunch of things in the bill that are encouraging, but we should note that, you know, just because two people sponsor a bill doesn't mean it becomes the law of the land, as we all know from watching Schoolhouse Rock. So, you know, there's a lot more work to be done to get that bill over the finish line or improve it and refine it.
So I hope listeners can tell that I come to the subject with just nothing but humility, because I find it so dense and convoluted, but in some ways it is so basic. And so I want to throw one more theory question at you, Ovik. When you're talking about scarcity, if there's scarcity of something, I don't know, like expired Campbell's soup, expired peanut butter, whatever.
Baby formula,
it is,
say.
Yeah, I say baby formula. But let's say there's scarcity of something that has no value, or that's questionable, or its value is dubious, I should say, you know, expired soup, whatever it is. Does the scarcity increase the value of something that has no value? And that's the question I would ask. And because I'm sure listeners who, if we have anti-crypto listeners, which I don't know that we do, but if we do, they're thinking, ask that question. And I know you've probably talked about that a million times, but what is the inherent value of Bitcoin other than being something that, I mean, all of the value that you just laid out, it's divorced from the system, et cetera, et cetera. Can you build with it like gold? Can you wear it like gold? This is what everyone was going to say. I know all the counter arguments to that. We are not on the gold standard anymore. And I think, you know, you can have a conversation about that too. But what's your response to that, I think, very basic theory question?
So first of all, most listeners to the Federalist Podcast believe in the laws of supply and demand, understand that the laws of the supply and demand are fundamental to economics. So it's not merely the supply of something, it's also the demand, right? So if you have scarce supply of something that has no demand, then it right. still has no value.
Right.
So the question is there demand? Right. And the demand in the case of Bitcoin comes from these two particular characteristics that I mentioned and several others, but in particular, the fact that it is protected against inflation because its supply mm-hmm. is fixed. And secondly, that it can be transmitted in a censorship resistant way, which is not as true of gold. So if I want to send $1 million of gold to Ukraine, how am I going to do it? How am I going to get that gold, those gold bars over the border to Ukraine? I got to take it out of a vault somewhere and carry it on an armored truck and like hope, you know, various, you know, bandits don't take it along the way. I mean, that's not so easy, right? But if I want to send, literally, if I want to send the prime minister of Ukraine $1 million Bitcoin, and I happen to have, or $1 million worth of Bitcoin, I happen to have $1 million of Bitcoin in my wallet, I can do that by pushing mm-hmm. two buttons, right? So that has real value. And for people who say it doesn't have value, tell that to the Ukrainians who've raised over $100 million again from their Bitcoin donation. Tell that to Alexei Navalny. Tell that to all the people who are dissidents around the world in tyrannical regimes who have benefited from the ability to raise money that their governments wouldn't like them to have. So mm-hmm. to say that there's no demand for a product like that, I mean, I just think you're not living in the real world if you think there's no demand for a product that is protected from debasement by governments and is protected from censorship by governments. So, you know, yes, in the US, we live in a relatively freer country, but we still suffer from some of these problems. And it's not that hard to envision an America in which Chase and Wells Fargo are pressured. They already been pressured to mm-hmm. deplatform, say, gun manufacturers. There was a initiative in the Obama administration to say, you know what, we're going to pressure banks. We're going to jawbone banks to say, no, you should not allow gun manufacturers to have bank accounts at your institutions. And these big banks are like, well, we got 20 million other things before the federal government that we need to, you know, we need to play nice with them on. So yeah, we'll throw the gun manufacturers overboard. What's it to us, right? And so it's not that hard to envision a world in which that is a more widespread problem. In which case, the use case for Bitcoin becomes even greater than it is today. And you better know, if you believe that Bitcoin has no value, that a lot of the people who own Bitcoin, if not all of them, are very aware of that, right? A big part of what owners of Bitcoin do today is say, you know what? Yes, it's true that today in this very moment, there may be multiple ways to protect my assets from debasement or censorship, but that may not always be true. In 10 years and 20 years, it may not be true that we live in a country where we have complete freedom to send our money to whoever we want, as the YouTube experience of the Federalist would indicate. Yes. So all that to say that, first of all, if you believe there's no demand for Bitcoin, well, empirically, that's not true. There clearly is demand because its price is where it is, which shows you that there is demand for it, right? The demand goes up and down relative to the supply, but there is demand, clearly. And if the argument is that it shouldn't have demand because America's awesome and would never try to take your money or block you from sending it to whom you want, then you're just not paying attention. The other thing I would say is that to the degree people say, well, some people say, and a lot of gold bugs will say this, let alone non-gold bugs. So, well, you can't hold it in your hand. It's just a bunch of, you know, numbers in the ether. Like, you know, gold, I can wear it as jewelry, like you said. You know, so it's not real. I mean, so if I read the Federalist on my web browser, it's not real. Is the information not real when I read it? Do I have to physically hold it in a printed copy in order for the information and the content to be real? I don't think so. I think we're actually capable of understanding that information can be transmitted in a digital way. Money can be too, because what is money? It's basically a form of information about economic value. That's one piece I'd bring up. Another thing I'd bring up is, so people say, well, you know, it's not like one thing you hear a lot of stock investors say, well, at least with a, you know, Warren Buffett would say this, but at least if I invest in Coca-Cola, Coca-Cola has revenue that it generates and it has profits that it generates. And the value of the stock price is at least somewhat connected to the earnings per share that come from the profitability of the company. It has cash flows. Bitcoin has no cash flows. It's just this thing. Well, that's also true of most commodities, right? I mean, like, you know, what is the value of gold? right? The value of gold is what the market thinks it is because of the demand for gold relative to its supply. What is the value of an Hermes tie relative to a tie you buy at Walmart? Right. It's the fact, it's not that it costs that much more to manufacture the Hermes tie. It's just that people think that, you know, if I wear an Hermes tie, I'll be cooler than if I wear a Walmart tie. So I'm willing to pay $200 for that. Or, you know, you get your Tom Brady jersey signed by Tom Brady because you think, hey, that's really cool. And it'll add value. And you go on eBay and you buy your autographed game worn Tom Brady jersey. And it's worth way more than if you just bought it at, you know, your local sporting goods store. People assign value art. Why is Picasso more important, you know, more valuable than me scrawling something on a piece of paper, right? There are lots of things that we assign value to, economic value to, that are subjective. Why do women consume cosmetics? It's a multi-billion dollar industry, right? But people do it. It has no functional value. It's not like you have improved health outcomes because you wore eyeliner today, right? But somehow we can actually value in the stock market the economic returns of a company that makes cosmetics, right? So I think when people talk about value, I think there's a lot of misunderstanding of what value is. Value and price, and this is something Mises and the Austrians understand very well. Value and price is nothing more than what people assign to it. All value is subjective. The value of gold is subjective. The value of cosmetics is subjective. The value of a can of Diet Coke is subjective. All of these things are based on, I as a consumer want this or do I not? And why I want something or why not may have something to do with my actual need for it, like shelter or food, or it may be completely subjective. Like, do I go out to a really nice restaurant to have lunch or do I, you know, have a bag of ramen noodles, right? That's the subjective decision. If I really want to be cost efficient and, you know, consume calories in the cheapest possible way, I'll consume, Coca-Cola and eat ramen, as many college students do. But if I want to be healthier or if I want to be fancier, whatever, I might be willing to spend more money for something different, right? So this is something that, you know, it's a very philosophical or abstract point in a sense, but it's really important for people to understand that prices and value are entirely driven by subjective decisions by people. They're not objective decisions, they're subjective decisions. But the importance of a free market and the importance of a free society is that we are allowed and enabled to make those decisions for ourselves and not have them determined for us.
Yeah, it seems to really test this false dichotomy that we've created between physical reality and virtual reality in important ways. Overgroy, thank you so much for tackling everything from inflation to the most basic theory of crypto. I so appreciate it.
Well, Emily, thank you. And thanks to everyone at the Federalist who do so much to show the value of an independent press. It's really important and really admire all the work you all do.
That's very kind of you. We appreciate that so much. Ovik Roy is the president of the Foundation for Research on Equal Opportunity. You can subscribe to their Substack. Ovik, what's the website?
The website is freeop.org, freeop.org. And the Substack is substack.freeop.org.
There you go. Perfect. Thanks, all right. Emma. Of course, you've been listening to another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at the Federalist. We'll be back soon with more. Until then, be lovers of freedom and anxious for the fray.